Hey, Rob.
Hey, Will. How you doing?
All right. How are you?
I'm great. I'm great.
So, this is such a great thing. We had, whose idea was it to have a couple of science reporters on right after the political conventions?
I don't know, because I guess they must have been so burnt out from all the partying in Denver and in the Twin Cities that they weren't thinking straight.
Yeah. Well, there's nobody I'd rather not party with than you, Rob.
Back at you, baby.
Yeah.
So we're supposed to introduce ourselves, right?
Okay. Will Salatan, Slate Magazine.
And Rob Stein, I'm a science and health reporter from the Washington Post.
Do we have to disclose that we are actually both owned by the same company?
I think you just did.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Washington Post Company.
That's right. We've done our duty.
Okay. So did you watch these conventions?
I did. I was riveted, actually. I thought they were both... I wasn't expecting to be staying home every night watching it, but I definitely did. How about yourself?
Did you actually stay... How many hours a night did you watch the convention?
I would say at least, an hour or two.
Yeah.
Maybe there might have been a couple nights where I missed it, but, I thought the theater of it, the speechifying, was much more interesting than I would have anticipated. I mean, it's definitely theater, but I got into it. How about yourself?
Well, I DVR'd it, to be honest, and went back and played it. And the funny thing is that we started out with my son Eli, who's 7, just about to be 8. He was complaining at the beginning that we were listening to replays of these political speeches when he wanted to be watching sports or something. But by the end, the conventions were over, and he's asking to have speeches played. He actually sat and watched Joe Lieberman. So, by the time you can get little kids to watch Joe Lieberman, you've really done your civic service as a parent.
Either that, or you're going to have to call a social worker to your house.
So there was, we have to talk about Sarah Palin, don't we? I mean, everybody else is, and we have our own angle from covering reproductive health stuff, right?
Absolutely. No, I think that there's a lot of fertile territory there, so to speak, to talk about.
Sarah and her daughter. That's doubly fertile territory.
Yeah, Sarah and her daughter. Well, I've been reading some really interesting stuff that you've been writing about this. The piece you wrote about other daughters.
That one got... I actually got called a neck-breathing pervert for writing that one. A neck-breathing pervert, which is really unfair because I've never breathed on anybody's neck, to be honest. well, actually, I can't say that. I was totally, fascinated by the two ends of the fertility spectrum. You know, we have Sarah Palin, age, was she 44 now, 45? I can't remember which.
Right, 44.
She's 44 now. She was 43 when she got pregnant. Her daughter got pregnant. I guess just having turned 17 and now is on the verge of turning 18. So, it can happen anytime, ladies. But I got in a lot of trouble for this. I should explain what this is about. There was all this uproar right when Bristol Palin's pregnancy got into the news.
Absolutely.
What is Sarah Palin, this supposedly upstanding mother, doing with a teenage daughter who's pregnant out of wedlock? And, so I thought, well, this can't be the first time this has happened. The only reason why we know about this pregnancy, right, is that she's having the baby. If the daughter decides she doesn't want to have the baby, or the parents decide they don't want her having the baby, and they persuade her, whatever word you want to use for it, compel her, there's no baby, there's just an abortion, but presumably the public never finds out about it.
That's right. So, but what makes you think that there was something to be found out about?
Well, some people were upset because, look, I don't have any evidence in any particular case. It is just statistically extremely likely that, given the fact that there are 37 women of childbearing age who have gone through as daughters of either the president, the vice president, or the losing parties on, the people on the losing ticket for president and vice president, over the course of about if you just do the math, 37 of these women multiplied by a certain number of years during which they were, fertile and presumably having just as much sex as anybody else at that age, unless the Secret Service stops them, and then divide by the number of years, that's about a 40-year span. It's probably somebody has gotten pregnant in that time, so this is probably not the first time.
Right, this is the first time that we've found out about it, probably.
Do you think that's unfair?
Well, so do you think? But I guess the question is: so do you think that that means that Sarah Palin is somehow getting a raw deal as a result of that?
Yeah, it sort of. I guess to me, it sort of changes what the question is. Is like, is she? You know, and is she a woman who didn't take, you know, care to teach her daughter the, you know, the right thing? Was she like one of these abstinence-only people who left her daughter unprepared for sex and therefore the daughter got pregnant? Or is that something that just happens very often as the
Now, wait a minute. So I want to stop it for a second.
Yeah.
These abstinence-only people who don't prepare their daughters, I mean, do you think that abstinence-only parents would say that, would characterize it that way?
No, to be fair. That was the reaction of, and you know, as you and I know, there's plenty of hypocrisy on all sides about this, right? But you're going to have people who presumably talk about family privacy, who are happy to then, you know, dig up everything they can about the Palin family and every pregnancy in it, and who are, you know, going to criticize her for not for what she taught or didn't teach her daughter, when if it happened in a Democratic family, presumably they wouldn't. They would think that was an invasion of privacy and unfairly questioning what Democrats think kids should be taught, which is, you know, also contraception and
right.
sex education. And of course, I guess the Republican argument is that that way your kid gave, if your daughter gets pregnant in that situation, it's because you gave her the mixed message, right?
Right, right. And you're basically, by encouraging your teenagers to have sex because they have a, they have protection.
Right.
Somehow. Right. So...
Well, do you think it's been unfair, this focus on Sarah Palin and how she raised her daughter and what her daughter decided or how she got pregnant?
Well, I think... I don't know if I characterize it fair as unfair. I definitely think it's a slightly different... view of the debate. I have to say that, because usually the debate is you know, either abstinence works or abstinence doesn't work, and what do you do about it when it doesn't work? And in this case, you know clearly you have somebody who's making family a big part of their public identity. So it seems like it's reasonable to examine the way the family dynamics work out.
Mm-hmm. So you're not. I guess I can't get you to editorialize on this, being a news reporter and all that.
Yeah, well, you know, that's going to be. We're going to be coming back to that a lot during this discussion, but no, you know, I'm not going to be making judgment. I think it's more interesting to sort of talk about the issues that these sorts of things raise.
Yeah.
And you know, certainly, this is a big difference between the parties. Clearly, the whole debate about abortion and choice and abstinence versus what they call comprehensive sex education.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's this certainly, you know, is pushed these issues directly into the forefront right away in this presidential debate, and they really hadn't been talked about very much.
Right. Right. It's true. It's like not concretely, because it's always a guy talking, and it's always an abstraction about when... Remember when McCain, 8 years ago, he had to talk about his daughter, right? What would you do if your daughter got pregnant? But... First of all, is, you know, the daughter wasn't pregnant, and secondly, he was the dad, so it wasn't quite as real as the daughter actually being pregnant and the mom being asked about it.
Right, right.
And a woman with her own pregnancy.
Right. So, yeah. So it's been interesting to see as a woman on the campaign actually walking around. I was reading someplace recently about it. Usually you have politicians kissing other people's babies. Here you have a politician carrying around their own baby.
Right. Right, and that's no. I think it's interesting that you raise this concept of choice and what it's all about, because there's so many different kinds of choice, and we hear the word pro-choice being thrown around, right? As a, if you're pro-choice, this is your position on abortion or contraception or whatever it is. But and one of the things that I love about your reporting, I think that you do a lot of illuminating about the differences. I mean, if we just take the Palin family, mm-hmm. in the case of Bristol's family. We have a question of, you know, she I believe the statement from the parents was that Bristol decided to have this baby. But at the same time, the public position of Sarah Palin when she, as governor of Alaska, when this issue came up, was that parents, not daughters, should be empowered to make that decision. In the case of the daughters, the underage daughters' pregnancy. So whose choice is it then?
Well, yeah, well, right, and obviously this is an issue that's important right now because of what's going on in California,
mm-hmm.
with the parental consent legislation that's pending out there.
Okay, so tell me a little about that.
Well, you know, I think abortion is on the ballot in three states coming up in November. You have the South Dakota situation, where they're requiring doctors to read this statement to women before they get an abortion. There's what's going on in Colorado, where there's a referendum on the ballot where they're going to be potentially declaring an embryo, giving personhood status to an embryo, and then there's the parental notification initiative that's happening in California.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've written about the California case.
Well, the South Dakota one, not really the California one.
Yeah.
But they're and it's like it's interesting because it's there are three different parts of the abortion issue, and they're all tackling different questions, right? There's like if the Colorado one passed, would that actually make abortion illegal, or would it at least lay the groundwork for making it absolutely illegal, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, the Colorado initiative, if that passes, that could have a lot of implications. But yeah, I mean, because if you're granting an embryo personhood status, then an abortion could be essentially equated to homicide.
Yeah.
That's a very controversial approach, even in the right to life community. That my understanding is that there's deep divisions within the Right to Life anti-abortion community about taking that approach because it is such an extreme position.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been similar initiatives in other states that haven't made it, but this is the one that's coming could be coming closest.
Yeah. And now South Dakota, my understanding is that what's happened there sort of bears out your point. There was an initiative similar to one that's up now about banning abortions except for risk to the woman's life, and that was considered too extreme, so they just brought back in a couple of exceptions for rape and incest.
Right.
And so that's back on the ballot, hoping that they can pick up the extra percentage of people for whom that was the sticking point.
Right.
It must be
right.
Pretty weird for people in New York to like hear about this stuff, like that the rape and incest exception is the divide is the crucial thing for getting 50% of the vote in another state, but that is the way it is.
Yeah, well, it seems to me that, don't you think that that's the sort of fine line that people start to feel uncomfortable about, even people who are anti-abortion when it comes to rape and incest,
mm-hmm.
that really people start to get very uncomfortable there.
That's true. Just like the parental consent issue is one where a lot of liberals who believe that the government should stay out of my family still think, well, geez, if it's my daughter's pregnancy, I want to have a say in that. And a lot of those people actually support parental notification or parental consent laws.
Right. Right. And so, I mean, but clear, that's not universally. I mean, there's a lot of folks in the pro-choice community who are really worried about that one. They see that as potentially creating a real obstacle for women to get abortions, young women.
Yeah. So now you've can we talk a little bit about the stuff that you've been writing about and some of the pharmacists, which is such a hot issue these days?
Oh, if you insist.
Okay, well, I do insist. I do insist because, I mean, what's really fascinating to me as an outside observer, and maybe you can explain some of this, is the way, you know, the way that the rhetoric of choice that has traditionally been used on the abortion issue by liberals to say the government should stay out of it and women should have this choice has been sort of co-opted and turned into this word conscience on behalf of doctors, pharmacists, and whatnot. So maybe you can sort of lay the landscape a little bit for me.
Yeah, well, what we're talking about is this big issue of what's called the right of conscience in healthcare, which, you know, this idea of conscience, right of conscience, has actually been around the United States, obviously, for, you know, since the founding fathers. And, you know, we think of it, have thought about it traditionally as like conscientious objectors to the war, for example. But it's become a really hot issue in the healthcare world when it comes to healthcare workers who are trying to assert who have been asserting what they call a right of conscience to object to performing different types of health care that they find morally offensive. And the most obvious one is abortion. And again, that's not new either. You know, right after Roe versus Wade passed, every state in the country, pretty much, passed laws that would allow doctors and nurses who didn't want to participate in abortions, who didn't want to have to do them, to protect them, so they wouldn't have to do them, so they could step aside, wouldn't be forced to perform abortions. And there are several federal laws that also provide that protection. But this issue has not gone away by any means. In fact, it's gotten a lot more intense in the last few years. Now, you made reference to the pharmacists. That's, I think, the area where people probably heard about this the most, and that's where you have pharmacists, you know, anti-abortion, pro-life pharmacists who, the most common example is they don't want to fill prescriptions for morning-after pills, what we, you know, people call Plan B, because they consider it equivalent to abortions. And this has been a huge issue around the country because pharmacists have been getting fired and reprimanded and getting in lots of trouble for running to assert this quote-unquote right of conscience.
Now, that you were saying the conscience issue has been around for as long as Roe v. Wade, right? But this particular part of it, the hormonal contraception part of it, is that new?
But that's sort of the latest wrinkle on it. Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. I mean, the Plan B is really what made this a huge issue when Plan B was up for approval as an over-the-counter medication. But it's basically what it's done is it's brought out something that's also been around for a long time, which is that there is a certain, you know, proportion of the population, healthcare professionals, certain doctors, nurses, pharmacists who basically equate with the morning after pill and birth control pills and other kinds of contraceptives like the IUD, they essentially consider them equivalent to abortion, which of course is not something that the most doctors and mainstream medical organizations agree with by any means, but they do. And so they don't want to be forced to have to participate in any of those services because they think it would be equivalent to making them perform an abortion or be a party to an abortion.
Okay, no, wait, all right, 'cause I have to back up now and say, how in God's name can the birth control pill or the morning after pill be considered an abortion? And I'm asking that question skeptically, although I'm sure you can lay out the science for me.
Yeah, as I say, this is not something that any of the major medical organizations or most doctors or scientists agree with. But the argument goes like this, that basically these birth control pills, the Plan B, could, in some circumstances, that it's not their major mode of operation, but in some cases could interfere with a fertilized egg. After it's been fertilized. Now, the way birth controls basically work is they suppress ovulation or they prevent an egg from getting fertilized in the first place. That everybody agrees that's basically how it works. But there is a possibility that in some circumstances, when an egg has been fertilized by somebody who's been taking the pill or the morning after pill, that it could then interrupt that process and, for example, prevent the fertilized egg from implanting in the womb. And for somebody who believes that life begins at conception, to them, that is the equivalent of an abortion.
And what is the probability that if you're taking the pill that you're getting, you're zapping a zygote?
You know, nobody really knows. Nobody really knows. It's very small. The probability is very small. Nobody's ever, you can't really calculate because there's no way to really do that experiment to know. But for those who believe that to be the case and find that morally unacceptable, even the smallest chance of that, they don't want to be a party to. And they don't feel like they should be forced to. And this has come up again most recently in this federal regulation that the Health and Human Services Department is trying to put into place right now.
Okay. So this is kind of interesting because I think of there's abortion and then there's birth control, but now, first of all, it sounds like we're blurring the line.
Yeah, we're conflating the two. That's what in this situation the two are being, I don't want to say we're blurring the lines. There's a debate about whether they are the same thing or not. As I don't think most people think of them as the same thing, and again, most of the medical community does not, but there is this minority of people who think that that's the case. And I've talked to a lot of them. I've talked to a lot of these nurses who work in hospitals and doctors who work in emergency rooms, and the idea that, you know, if a woman comes into an emergency room and she thinks she might be pregnant because she was raped, or because her birth control, you know, method she was using didn't work, or she didn't use it, and she wants the morning after pill, they feel very uncomfortable giving it to her because they feel like they'd be participating in something that would be equivalent to an abortion.
Now, did they draw a distinction between the just regular plain old oral contraception, a pill that you're nominally taking to prevent prevent pregnancy, and the morning after pill, which also is designed that, but is after the sex act? Do they care about that distinction?
No, they don't. I mean, they know that there is a distinction. They know that they are used in different ways, but they, again, believe that there's a possibility that they could interfere with a fertilized egg and therefore, you know, stopping a life once it's begun.
The thing that's bothering me about this is the notion that this, as you're saying, historically this is provoked by Plan B, right? That's the thing that sort of got this whole... that move the conscience debate into this territory, is that right?
I think it is what has sort of ignited it and made it more of an issue. I mean, you know, folks have felt this way about the birth control pill for many, many years, but because the debate has become much more public because of the advent of the morning after pill. Yeah, you're right.
Okay, but see, that's what totally... See, I wasn't... And I'm somebody who has tried to follow this issue for a while, and I wasn't aware that plain old birth control pills were really, you know, that there was really much of a debate about them, except if you were against contraception altogether. And the notion that Plan B sort of provokes this makes me... I still feel like it's an unscientific thing where... you know, it's the fact that the morning after pill is the morning after that sort of gets people thinking that some line has been crossed, whereas biologically that's just not true because we're still pre-fertilization.
Right. That's the way it generally does work. But you know, the morning after pill is essentially it is the birth control pills.
It's
the same hormones. And it's just used at a different point. And so the way that it might be problematic is the same for both of them because they are the same medications. So, again, in the eyes of people who believe that life begins at conception and who don't want to participate in anything that has the smallest chance of having any impact on that, they're equivalent.
Okay, now, is that reasonable or just crazy? I mean, it's one thing to me if somebody says, look, I don't want to participate in an abortion, you are going in there to kill a fetus or an embryo, whatever you want to call it. It is a developing human being. In the case of, as you're saying, it's like an extremely small chance. And that's, first of all, it's not, in the case of the birth control or the morning after pill, the intent seems to me still to be to prevent the pregnancy, right? Isn't that it? And the chance that you're doing anything but that you're zapping the zygote is infinitesimal. So is that a reasonable definition of conscience?
Well, you know, a reasonable definition of conscience. You know, there is a long history in this country of being tolerant of different people's views and different people's perspectives. Now, let me put it this way. Scientifically, the chances of the birth control pill or the morning after pill actually having that effect is very, very small. But it's not totally crazy to use your words. I mean, it is theoretically a possibility that it can happen in some circumstances. How often it happens, nobody really knows. And so, if you're somebody who, it's like saying, you're forcing somebody to participate in something, you know, let's use an example of an execution, for example. Should a doctor be forced to participate in capital punishment? if they believe that it's morally wrong. If there's the smallest chance that the birth control pill or the morning after pill could interfere with a fertilized egg, why should somebody be forced to participate in that act if they find it morally offensive? Even if it's the chances are very, very small, they're not zero. So the argument goes, we shouldn't force anybody to participate in anything that might be morally offensive when there are alternatives available.
Well, all right, but in the case of capital punishment, that's 100%.
Right.
You're flipping the switch, or you're, you know, injecting, and you are there to, first of all, it's a living, breathing adult, and secondly, you are there to kill them, period. And there's no question of, you know, whether it's born
so,
or...
So let me ask you this, where would you draw the line? If there's a 50% chance of doing something that somebody finds offensive, or a 40% chance, or a 20% chance, or a 10% chance, or what about a 1% chance?
Okay, I'll give you the counter argument. The slope, first of all, the slope runs both ways. You know, you can't, if you're going to start at, I mean, is it going to be zero? Is it really going to be zero? If it's going to be zero, say, you can exercise your right of conscience. And by the way, the government, the federal government of the United States, the Department of Health and Human Services, will reach in with its long arm and exert financial pressure on your employer to make sure that they suppress their conscience to honor your conscience, so that you don't ever have to participate in something that has a 0.15% chance of causing a 3-day embryo to die. If we extend the conscience protection that far, then why should I, if I am terrified of the slightest possibility of causing a miscarriage, why shouldn't I be able to say that although I work at Starbucks, I'm entitled to refuse to serve caffeinated beverages to any woman of childbearing age on the chance, the greater than zero chance, that she has already conceived and is not yet aware of it because the pregnancy, that the embryo has not yet implanted?
Well, I think there is a quality. You could make the argument that there is a qualitative difference there, because you're dealing with somebody where there's a chance that there might have been a fertilization might have occurred, and so your intent is to prevent a pregnancy from occurring. Whereas somebody working in Starbucks, it's completely out of the realm of anything that you're dealing with. Whereas you're dealing with in a medical situation where somebody might very well be pregnant. That's the whole reason why you're administering this medication. You're working at Starbucks. You have no reason to suspect that you might be dealing with a potentially pregnant person.
I gotta follow up on that. All right, in neither case is the intent to zap a zygote, right? And It's not true if you come in, you know, and you say, you know, I need a morning after pill, I'm not there to zap a zygote. I'm there to, and the instructions on the pill say that's not the point is to prevent the ovulation and the fertilization, right?
Right.
So right, right. And there it is still not, it's not intent, and the chance that I haven't done the math on this, but I think it's entirely plausible, at least, that the probability of the caffeinated beverage triggering a miscarriage is somewhere in the ballpark, if not greater than the probability that morning after pill zapping a zygote.
Well, who knows? We don't know what the probabilities are, because nobody really knows what the probabilities are of the morning after pill having that impact, or birth control pill having that impact. But I have to, you know, make it clear here that I am in no way putting myself on one or the other side of this debate. I'm just trying to lay out sort of what the arguments are on either side of the debate. And this is the big issue. This is the big issue is of balancing these two rights that our society does believe to be really important. And one is the right of, on one side is the right of somebody to follow their conscience, which we have a long history of honoring in this country, and the other one is the right of people to get access to health care. And this is an era where these two rights are coming directly into conflict and raising just the sort of questions you and I are talking about. And I think you can't just write off the argument on one side that it's that it's a non-issue. That just because these medications were not designed to work this way, and most of the time don't work that way, that we shouldn't have to worry about it, and there's no issue here at all. But on the other hand, I think there are huge issues being raised by this, because if you follow this out to its logical conclusion and allow anybody to object to anything that they find offensive, like that extreme example that you decided, that's a Starbucks worker. I mean, you can imagine. You don't even have to make you go that extreme in your example. All you have to do is follow the logical argument of what this federal regulation that we're talking about, what the effect might be, and it could have enormous implications and create enormous barriers to patients getting access to legal, safe, government-approved medical care. And actually, I kind of feel like at this point we should maybe step back a little bit and explain what we're talking about.
Okay.
About this conscience regulation that the federal government's
okay. Tell me about that conscience regulation.
Yeah. Basically, I'll try to make it quick. Basically, what it is the Department of Health and Human Services is planning to put into effect a regulation that would require basically every healthcare organization in the country. We're talking about hospitals, clinics, entire states, doctor's offices, to basically guarantee that anybody, that they will safeguard the conscience rights of all their employees. That means they can't refuse to hire anybody, and they can't fire anybody or reprimand or discipline or penalize anybody in any way who wants to object to something that they find morally offensive, such as administering birth control pills or the morning after pill. And what this regulation would do is if any entity, a hospital or a clinic, refuses to do this, they could lose all their federal funding. So it's a big threat. People are, you know, in the pro-choice community are extremely worried about this, what the impact could potentially be.
So what are some of these hard cases that you're alluding to if we extend conscience, what kind of trouble do we get? What kind of troubling or difficult areas do we get ourselves into besides the ones?
Well, I mean, you can imagine a scenario. This is okay. I'll lay out sort of the nightmare scenario that folks like Planned Parenthood and NARAL have spun out in describing what the impact of something like this might be. You could, for example, have anti-abortion activists apply for jobs at an abortion clinic, let's say a Planned Parenthood clinic, and walk in the door and say, I'm opposed to abortion, but I want a job here as a secretary. Now, theoretically, under this regulation, the clinic would have to hire those people, even though they could sit at the front desk, and when somebody calls up to make an appointment, refuse to make that appointment because they say that they would then be participating in something they find morally repugnant, which is an abortion.
Okay, and has anything like that been litigated? I mean, as a judge, I kind of laughed that one out, but I don't know if anything's been litigated.
Nothing that extreme has been litigated, but, you know, there have been a lot of cases around the country getting at this issue with, you know, for example, what you talked about earlier with the pharmacists. You know, there are lots of cases around the country of pharmacists who are refusing to fill prescriptions of birth control pills and have been reprimanded or fired or fined. And most of the cases, they've lost most of the cases, actually. But what does happen is at the same time, most institutions, this is the way the law works, is that you are required, if you're a hospital or a clinic or any other organization, to try to accommodate somebody's rights of conscience. Meaning that, like most pharmacy chains, for example, have policies in place where if you are one of these pharmacists, you can work there. They just have to have some system in place to accommodate you. For example, another pharmacist that can sort of step in and take over. So, you know, there are lots of attempts to sort of balance these competing rights.
Okay. All right. Here's what I'm having trouble with. What you've laid out is very complicated, and it's hard for me to understand how balance fits into it. For example, let me see if I understand the structure of how this incredibly complicated choice situation works. The woman walks into the pharmacy. She has the birth control prescription. That's her choice. She's choosing, you know, to exercise this, and her doctor has signed off on it. So the doctor has already made a decision.
Right.
The pharmacist says, "No, I can't do that."
Right.
Okay, that's his choice. The employer of the pharmacist, the pharmacy or the drugstore, whatever the heck it is, says, you have to fill this prescription like any other, or you're fired. The state says the pharmacist has to fill prescriptions, even if the employer doesn't. So I mean, I'm just spinning out one of these. There are state laws that do this, right? And then the federal government, in the form of the Department of Health and Human Services, comes in and says, no, you state and you employer can't tell the pharmacist what to do about the woman's request that the doctor signed off on. Because we, in the name of conscience, that particular conscience that we've plucked out of this chain of consciences, has to rule.
Yeah, you know, it is a big mess, to make it short, but this is the deal. Around the country, there are laws already in place all over the country, and there are lots of others that are, you know, pending in state legislatures and being debated, that on one side or the other, there are lots of laws that require pharmacists to fill prescriptions, and there are laws on the books that protect pharmacists who don't want to fill prescriptions. And as I said, most, like big pharmacy chains have policies in place to try to work this out so that you can have somebody working at a pharmacy who doesn't want to fulfill the prescriptions, but they can still do their jobs, and the woman will still get her prescription anyway. And it's you know, basically it requires another pharmacist to be on call or present at the time, or for the pharmacist to, you know, refer the customer, the patient, to another pharmacy where they can get their prescription filled. And you know, this is something that's been going on for years. I mean, ever since Roe versus Wade, there have been, you know, doctors and nurses working in hospitals who don't want to perform abortions, and they work there. And what happens when a patient comes in that wants an abortion and they don't want to do it? What happens is they step away, and it happens very quietly, sort of under the radar, and it's been going on like that for years. And this accommodation happens on a daily basis in hospitals and doctors' offices around the country.
Okay, so then why did the federal government get involved now?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. That's a very good question, and a lot of people are asking that question because, as I said, there have been these laws on the books. It's the Weldon Amendment, the Church Amendment, that are on the books that basically guarantee this right of conscience. Now, what happened here was that Secretary of Health and Human Services Mike Leavitt got wind of an ethics ruling that came down from a group called it's called ABOG. It's a group of obstetricians and gynecologists, basically ruling that if you're an obstetrician, you're a gynecologist, you have a moral objection to abortion, that you should. At least you have an obligation to at least inform all your patients of what their options are and refer your patients elsewhere. Now, that's what got Secretary Leavitt worried, because he became concerned that that would become something that would be required of doctors, or they'd lose their certification. That's really what got this whole thing going. Now, there's a lot of debate about that, where the groups, the OBGYN groups, saying, look, that was never the intention here. We were just trying to lay out sort of the ethical guidelines that doctors should follow. But in response to that, that's what got Secretary Leavitt going on this and decided to issue this regulation. He's saying, basically, he's trying to make sure that these federal laws that have been on the books for decades now are basically being enforced. He thinks they're not being enforced. That's what he's worried about.
Okay. All right. So let's say, all right, I'm a libertarian. I say that somewhat hypothetically, but also I am basically kind of a libertarian. So my libertarian instincts, I want to not have the government making these decisions for individuals, but I'm faced, you're presenting me with this very complicated chain of agents, some of whom are individuals, some of whom are collective, some of whom are private, public. I mean, what is ACOG? What is ABOG? Is that a private organization? Is that a public organization?
These are professional organizations. It's like the AMA, basically. It's the equivalent of the AMA for obstetricians and gynecologists. And again, nobody's requiring anything in here. It was an opinion issued by an ethics committee, a guidance, and for how obstetricians and gynecologists should do their jobs. Now, the concern was that it could somehow translate into something punitive for OBGYNs, anti-abortion OBGYNs. But you know what? It really, that was just part of it. You know, the original draft version of this regulation cited all these laws and proposed laws around the country that were that were started popping up in all these state legislatures in response to what was going on with the pharmacists. So it's all sort of interconnected. There's been a lot of, you know, sturm and drum about this in the medical world, and it's gotten the attention of, you know, folks like Levitt.
Okay.
So
now,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to just ask you about you and I have been following this, how they changed the language that was in the regulation and what the heck we should make of that.
Yeah. The original, there was a draft version of the regulation that leaked back in July, and that's really what freaked people out in the pro-choice community, was there was this definition of abortion in the draft version of the regulation that would have, if it had become part of a final regulation or a federal law, it would have been the first time that anybody can think of, anyway, that would have specifically defined abortion this way, and it would define abortion in the way that we've been talking about, which is anything that it interferes with a fertilized egg. So that would mean that birth control pills and the morning after pill and IUDs would be considered equivalent of abortion. Now, that, you know, that didn't end up in the final version that was proposed last month. They ended up dropping that.
So does the regulation, so now if I'm a pharmacist and I want to invoke this regulation, can I do so or not?
Yeah. That's the thing, is that although they dropped that specific language that everybody's freaking out about, the language that remains in the proposal that finally came out is basically very broad and kind of vague, and it doesn't specify, it doesn't define abortion, but basically says that a healthcare worker should be protected against performing any duties that they find objectionable. And so, you know, if I'm a pharmacist and I think Plan B is the equivalent of abortion, I should be protected.
Okay, now I'm having a problem with that, because it's one thing, it seems to me, to say I get to invoke my conscience on a moral question, but it's another thing for me to say, you know, I get to invoke my conscience on a scientific question. That is to say, as you were just describing it, I don't remember exactly what the regulation says, that anything that I perceive to be, you know, an abortion, like, do you get to have make your own judgment about whether this theoretical risk makes this pill abortifacient?
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting point, because, you know, we're talking mostly about abortion, and that's the thing that most people are concerned about, and that's what most of the debate has been about. But, you know, there are folks also who have a lot of other concerns about this. There are folks, for example, in the end of life field who are supporters, for example, of physician-assisted suicide, who think that, say that this same regulation could be used to protect people who don't want to participate in that. Or, for example, if you have a nurse who doesn't want to remove a feeding tube or doesn't want to take somebody off of a ventilator, you know, like in the Schiavo case, that this would protect them in that kind of situation. So it's actually, the implication of this could be far broader than just abortion. It could be end-of-life issues. There's some people who think this just means if you're a doctor or a nurse and you don't want to treat gay people, that because you find their lifestyle morally offensive, that youth should be protected in that situation.
Well, I have to stop on the gay thing. That's okay. So, like, I mean, to me, as somebody who, you know, writes about this stuff, and I hear you being very careful to honor, you know, the principles on both sides and the beliefs on both sides, regardless of what you think or what I think. And I don't even know if what you and I think the same thing or not. But the point is, it's like, to me, on life stuff, I find myself being very deferential to the pro-life people. Like, you know, if you, you know, have a concern about abortion, it's, you know, from your point of view, it's a kind of killing, and I can totally relate to how that would be a grave issue to you. But, like, you're saying in the case of adoption, they wouldn't be able to invoke the same regulation to say, I'm sorry, you're a couple of lesbians, I can't do IVF for you?
That's the concern, that this, you know, now, of course, we'll have to wait and to see what happens to this regulation once it goes into place, and then to see how people start to use it, because it's so broadly written that, you know, it's unclear if people will use it that way, but that's a possibility. And, you know, there was this case just recently out in California of this a lesbian who was trying to get pregnant and her doctor refused to inseminate her because the doctor claimed it ended up in litigation, and then the doctor claimed that she was refusing because the woman wasn't married, and the woman was claiming that she was being discriminated against because she was gay. Mm-hmm. And that ended up in litigation. That just there was a ruling just came down about that case in the California Supreme Court this summer.
Mm-hmm.
For the case of the lesbian woman, basically interpreting the state civil rights statute, saying that the doctor did not have a right to refuse to deliver care to her. But you know, that's the thing about this stuff is that it's all subject to interpretation of, you know, state laws, and this stuff is regulated generally on a state level, state by state, with state medical boards, state pharmacy boards, and state civil rights laws. And so it's, you know, it's hard to know how this could play out in another setting, in another state.
Yeah. Well, I got to say, it makes me the part where you start getting out of the life stuff and into other things, particularly into the gay stuff. Now you're into sort of family structure. I mean, can somebody say to you know, Sarah Palin, I'm sorry, I don't approve of, you know, teen motherhood, a pregnancy out of wedlock. I'm not going to provide your prenatal care. Can they just do that under the? That just strikes me as wild.
Yeah, well, that's I mean, you can sort of spin out all sorts of scenarios with this sort of thing, and where you draw the line is the key question, and it depends obviously on your personal perspective. I mean, I think it's interesting. So that you could sort of defend this when it comes to abortion, but you couldn't defend it when it comes to how about physician assisted suicide, for example.
Well, there you're still on a life question, and I honestly, Rob, I'm just going by visceral feeling about it. Like, as long as you're on a life or a killing question, I feel like being very deferential. I certainly feel like being deferential where there's like 100% probability somebody has a problem with the death penalty, and it strikes me as very easy to find an alternative, somebody else to like handle the there are very so few cases of death penalty actually being applied. But you know, you get into something like pregnancy, and it just happens so often. I mean, you tell me. It sounds like that they are able. The pharmacies are able to like get somebody else to handle each prescription.
Yeah. Well, you know that. Right. That's the thing. Is that, as I said before, this has been going on for years with abortion, and we don't even hear about it. Right. There have been doctors and nurses refusing to perform abortions in hospitals for decades now, and we just don't hear about it because usually it's not a problem. And you know what? The reality is, usually it's not a problem for pharmacists either. But the point is that most of the time there's another pharmacist, you know, they could just step in and take over, and the customer, the patient, won't even know that it happened. But not always. And I think, again, one of the reasons why this has become such much more of a public issue because of Plan B is because of the time sensitivity of Plan B. You need to use it within 72 hours, and if you're a woman, you know, in a rural area in the middle of the night, and there's not another pharmacy nearby, you don't know where it is, you don't know how long it's going to take you to get there, then it becomes a real issue. The concern is that, if this spreads and more pharmacists are, you know, refusing to fulfill these prescriptions, that it become harder and harder, and it could become create real boundaries, barriers for women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the same issue. It's a bit going on with these hospital mergers, with Catholic hospitals taking over other hospitals. You know, in a city, a major American city, where there are options and alternatives, you know, basically women can find a place to get the services. But if you're in a rural area with only one hospital and it gets taken over by a Catholic hospital chain and they don't perform abortions or they don't deliver, they won't give you Plan B, then it becomes a real problem.
Right. And that's the thing that bothers me is, like, it's one thing. Originally, you're describing a scenario where a doctor, an individual, says, I cannot in good conscience perform abortions or participate in them. Fine. That's a single individual. You take them out of the equation. There's somebody else on staff who can do it. Now we get to the level of this collective level where the Catholic hospital, which includes everybody who works for the hospital, is exercising conscience. You're just taking everybody out of the equation in that area. And that I have a lot more trouble with as a conscience thing. To me, the whole nature of conscience is that it's individual. So it feels weird to me to invoke that on behalf of an institution.
Well, yeah, but that's been the case for decades. I mean, we haven't made any Catholic hospital chain perform abortions. That we never do that. And again, it is becoming more of an issue because of what the economics of the hospital industry, and a lot of hospitals closing. There used to be many more hospitals in any given area than there are right now. But I mean, how else do you, you know, doctors and nurses work in institutions? So you have to, these become institutional issues.
Yeah.
And inevitably become institutional issues. If you're a pharmacist, you, chances are you work for a big pharmacy chain. So big institutions have to deal with these issues. They have to have policies to deal with them. And that's, that's what this, you know, HHS reg is aimed at. It's aimed at basically forcing, making sure that these big institutions are protecting people from doing things that they don't want to do, and figuring out a way to accommodate them. Now, you know, Secretary Leavitt made a point of saying, look, we're not requiring, we're not barring anybody from doing anything. We're not saying, you know, X hospital, you can't perform abortions. We're just saying that if you perform abortions, you can't force somebody who works for you to do them.
Okay.
Which is a difference. It's a key difference.
So I think the pumpkin's probably, our carriage is going to turn into a pumpkin, right? So we should probably figure out, where do you think all this stuff is going? Do you see any new twists and turns in the development?
Oh, yeah, I think it's actually going to get more intense as time goes by. I mean, just think about stem cells. That's the most obvious one.
Uh-huh.
If stem cells, you know, start to become real therapies and widely used, there are lots of people out there who have real moral problems with stem cells and where those stem cells came from.
Mm-hmm.
And you could easily see doctors and nurses and refusing to deliver stem cell therapy to people.
And could we work around them? I mean,
yeah, we'll have the same. It'll be the same sort of issues, having to find somebody else to do it, and some other way to deliver it. So I think that you're going to see this. This is, issue is not going away. I guess I was just curious, sort of what you thought about. I mean, whether none of this has been any so far has really been an issue in the presidential election at all.
Yeah. It's sort of. To the extent this issue has come up so far, it's been the Democrats shifting their platform to acknowledge that abortion reduction is a good thing, and the Republicans trying to make an issue of Barack Obama supposedly being against regulating late-term, like extremely late-term abortions, like after the baby's been delivered and survived, which I think is
right.
Bogus. But that's it. None of this stuff about the contraception has really been made an issue by the campaign.
Yeah, and are you surprised at all about that? Especially with, you know, Palin, you would think it would have become that, if anything, would have thrust it into the forefront.
Well, I think what's basically going on is, although I'm interested in this issue and you're interested in this issue, the people who run the campaigns know better than us. You know, they just sort of look. If you're the Republicans, you talk. Yeah, they did in their convention talk about a culture of life, right? And McCain used that term, and. You know, Fred Thompson said something about protecting the unborn. They all said something because they know their people will vote, the pro-lifers will vote single issue on that. The Democrats, they might have on balance more people on their side, but they're not going to vote on the one issue. Plus, they have these two strong issues in the economy being in the tank and the people being unhappy with the Iraq war. And why fuzz that up by getting into these complicated social issues? I don't even think they want to talk about Sarah Palin in general, the Democrats. So I just think the Democrats are going to ignore this so they can pound relentlessly on Iraq and the economy.
And I guess the issue where Palin comes into play is really just sort of energizing the Republican base.
Yeah, and it's sort of like this is the way politics was before, you know, there was the Brett Webster versus Reproductive Health Services, the Supreme Court decision that threw this back into the public. I mean, it would be back, you know, back when only the pro-lifers cared, we're back to, again, where only the pro-lifers care, and I see the pro-choicers mobilize on the web, maybe they donating money, but it's not like, it's not really become a voting issue the way that it was when people thought that abortion might become illegal.
You'd think, though, with the Supreme Court potentially at stake, that this should be on people's minds.
Well, gee, I don't get the impression people are actually, my recollection is that abortion became a hot issue after the collapse of the Soviet Union and when the economy was in good shape. And so it was like, you know, the social issues came up to the top. But when people are worried about national security and, you know, buying a tank of gas, it feels like this just gets buried.
It's a hierarchy of needs. We got more important things to worry about.
What do we know? Here we are, a couple of guys talking about, you know, the hierarchy of needs involving pregnancy when it's not really in our body. So it's a little bit, maybe I don't want to be too cavalier about it, but. But, you know, look, if those women want to make abortion a voting issue or birth control a voting issue, they're going to have to come out and vote on it in a way that historically people just haven't.
Right, right. And it doesn't look like that's going to be any different this time around.
So I guess I should let you go back to your science work and I go back to my science work and we continue to be, I guess, spectators of the grand political event.
Well, it's fun, isn't it?
It is, it is. But I'm happy to be an observer and occasionally get to put my finger in it.
Yeah, me too. Me too, Will. Well, it's been really great fun.
You too, Rob. Take care.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye.